Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more podcasts about movies and nostalgia, visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, a podcast where, I don't know, should we continue to try and describe what this podcast is as it continues to evolve, or should we just give up on that?
Oh, do you think it's different than it used to be? I think it's still the same podcast.
It's definitely still the same podcast. We're a bit more open concept, I think, though. Or at least I would like to be a little more open concept.
Well, do you want to make up a new thing?
Yeah, eventually.
But not right now.
Not right now. In the meantime, I'm Kara Gallo-Regan. With me, as always, is my co-host, Jordan Poland-Clark.
Hello.
And coming at you with another couple of firsts. Last episode was the first time that we recorded looking at each other in our faces in person. This time, first time we're recording during the day, and first time we're recording across international boundaries.
Yes, it is 3:16 p.m. and I am in Canada.
It is also 3:16 p.m. and I am in New York.
I feel weird doing this early in the day.
Yeah.
So if we sound confused, that's why.
I have a feeling I'll be, like, less confused than I am at nighttime, though.
Oh, I'll be more confused and, like, less focused because also all my surroundings are different now. Mm. Like, usually I'm sitting in, like, my very cozy leather chair, and now I'm just sitting at a desk.
Yeah. I actually usually record in the bedroom, and here I am out in the living room on the couch because it's fucking hot. Tell us, why are you in Canada?
Because I saved up a bunch of money for a couple years so that I could not work and hang out for 2 months.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
Where are you hanging out?
Well, so far, mostly just around my apartment because it's only been a day and a half. And I'm trying to get my bearings. And today, I'm going to venture out into the city to see a circus show. I don't know.
That's exciting. I don't think you said it, but you're in Montreal.
I'm in Montreal.
Which is such a beautiful city. And I am very jealous that you get to be fun employed there for a couple of months.
Well, oh yeah, fun employed. That's what people call this, isn't it?
Yeah.
I forgot that was a thing. I used to have to be fun employed, like, not by choice, because I worked on a TV show. But, yeah, this is different than that.
Yeah, it's more purposeful.
I hope. I don't know. It really hasn't been so far.
Yeah. Well, if you run out of things to do, definitely visit the botanical gardens.
I can't wait to go there. And they have a planetarium there, which I love. I love planetariums.
Me too. I didn't get a chance to check that out, but when I was there, they were hosting this, like, big international botanical sculpture show. Mm-hmm. It was really interesting. All these different countries had different botanical sculptures that they created. Mm-hmm. It was just, like, a really hard thing to describe, but they're, like, I guess, well, I don't know how they make them. My guess would be that they, like, create, like, a big wire armature and then cover it with, like, moss and greens and flowers and stuff. So one of them, and I think it was Japan's entry, I don't know for sure, but it was a large, and when I say large, I mean, like, larger than life by several orders of magnitude, a large grand piano with a waterfall coming out of it and a turtle jumping out. I'm not sure what that was supposed to signify, but it was beautiful.
Sounds cool, though.
Yeah, it was a neat time to be there. Also, they have a really excellent Japanese garden with a little bonsai tree house where they have bonsai trees that are, like, hundreds of years old.
Ooh, cool.
Mm-hmm. So, you have that to look forward to.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Kara, what movie did we watch?
We watched An American Tale.
Yes.
It's an animated film from, oh God, I didn't write down any of the details of it, so let me just pull it up on IMDb.
I can tell you as much as I know, which is not a lot. It's an animated film from 1986.
There you go.
That's all the facts I have.
All right.
Besides the fact that I also watched the movie and know what happens in the movie.
Yeah. Yes, An American Tale, 1986. While emigrating to the United States, a young Russian mouse gets separated from his family and must relocate them while trying to survive in a new country. So, it was my idea to watch this movie because when news broke about the family separations that have been happening at the border a few weeks ago, I just like couldn't stop thinking about this movie and how much I loved it and how relevant it was to, it felt very relevant to what is going on with our current situation. Ugh, I don't know. It's all so terrible.
Well, right. And but, like that just made it like that much more horrible to watch it.
Yeah.
Like it was very sad.
It is very sad, but it's really, really powerful.
There is, like, so I was reading, like, some reviews of it from when it first came out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the criticism was, like, that it was too sad. Which, like, but I don't remember ever thinking as a kid that it was too sad. Because, like, I knew that Feifel was going to find his family. Like, because that's how kids' movies work. And so, right. like, I didn't. I just, you know, kid brains aren't really smart enough to pick up on how sad it is, no matter what the ending is. But also, in my adult brain, I'm like, oh no, kids really get separated from their families, and then they really never see them again.
Yeah.
So that made it so much more upsetting. Like, every time he thought he found them, and then he didn't, I cried so much.
Yeah, and I actually, there's a sequel to this movie, An American Tale, Feifel Goes West, which I also watched, and which is really also quite spectacular. And it was, so in that one, we'll get into this a little bit more, but about like American myth-making and that sort of thing. But he and his family are hearing these tales about, you know, how out west everyone, cats and mice and dogs, they all live together, you know, harmoniously, and everybody helps
essentially,
each other out. And
which is, sorry to stop you, but which is essentially the plot of this one also.
Right.
They are in Russia.
But they say there are no cats
like,
in America.
When we get to America, there will be no cats at all.
And the streets are paved with cheese.
And then they arrive and obviously find out very quickly that New York is filled with cats.
And there's no cheese in the streets.
There's no cheese in the streets.
But in Feifel Goes West, he gets separated from his parents again.
How,
and it's like
so home alone. He can't keep his family.
But it's like multiple times we, both in this, in American Tale and in Feifel Goes West, we see his parents see him disappear like multiple times over and over and over again, all kind of in very similar ways, where Feifel is like chasing after his hat or something, and then he gets washed overboard, or then he falls off a train
one,
or like whatever.
I don't know what he does in the second one, but in the first one he's just being like a sneaky little kid, and he throws his own hat because he wants to, what is he, they're on the ship on the way to America from Russia, and he wants to see the fish, I think, like he wants to go up on the deck, but it's a really big storm, but he's really, how old do you think he's supposed to be in the first one?
Oh,
like six?
Couldn't be more than like six.
Yeah,
I think that's a
so
good
he's like, he's smart, but he's not that smart, so there's this big ass storm.
Very poor self-protective instincts.
Yeah. And he, well, he's brave, like, and he wants he wants to take risks, you know? So he throws his own hat to the deck so that he can go see the fish during the storm, and then never comes back from that.
Yeah. Because he gets washed overboard, and then he, like, winds up in a bottle and just, like, floats in a bottle, and then some bird from the Statue of Liberty finds him. And I just, animation and like the world building in this mm-hmm. movie is so great, because like for all of the systems that humans have going through immigration and stuff like that, like there's all of these parallel mouse systems. Mm-hmm. So like you see them also like going through immigration and like all of these like things, just like any other person who is immigrating to the United States at that time would have to go through these processes. So do the mice. And it just feels so, I don't know, like it makes it just feel so real. And even back the opening of the film, and like I said to you, like the first 15 or 20, like I don't know how like the rest of it is, but the first 15 or 20 minutes is really powerful, where we actually see Fievel and his family in Russia, and the Cossacks come through and like the Cossacks and their cats come through and light their Jewish village on fire, and so they lose their homes and are forced to emigrate. And
do you know,
I don't know, I just
it never occurred to me when I was young that they were Jewish. Like I knew that they were Jewish,
yeah, me neither,
but I never like thought about it.
Yeah, the first note that I made was that I forgot how Jewish this movie is, like in a really wonderful way, which I think is also important at this point in time where we have literal Nazis running amok. But
the mom has a great Jewish mom line in the beginning.
Yeah.
The Fievel gets a hat.
Yeah, this family heirloom.
It's like huge and adorable. It doesn't fit him. And his dad gives it to him and he's like, thank you, Papa. Thank you, Papa. And she looks at him and she's like, you only have one parent? So Jewish mom.
Yeah. She has a lot of really good moments in this movie. Like I was talking about before, seeing his parents see him get taken away over and over. It happens so many times that I can't remember like which time it is that like Fievel is gone from the family, and they just are like, well, he's gone now. He's dead. That's like, we'll never see him again. And like the acceptance that like they're so ready to, like they've seen so much loss and they've been through so much loss that it's, at least for his parents, kind of like a muscle that they've built mm-hmm. at this point. And at one point his sister Tanya says that she thinks he's still alive and he's still out there, and his mother says, don't worry, after a while it will go away.
Mm-hmm.
And that just like broke my heart, because to be able to say that like requires so much previous loss.
Yeah.
So this movie to me was like so different watching it now as an adult with like an understanding of what loss is and like grief and that sort of thing. And seeing it much more kind of through his parents' eyes than through like the adventurous child.
Yeah, it's like what we talked about when we watched Little Women.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's such a different time. People are just used to sickness and death and shitty stuff. I mean, not that people don't have to get used to and live with that now, but it's really different.
Yeah, but I love how triumphant this movie winds up being for all of the immigrant mice. And like, it's not just a Jewish movie, it's very much an immigrant movie, and we see some problematic stereotypes, but like, whatever, painting with a broad brush, this is an animated film, that when they're on the boat and they're all singing There Are No Cats in America, which is this wonderful musical number, there's, you know, they're the mice from all of these different places are like singing and dancing together and saying like, oh, you think Russia was bad? Well, Sicily, blah, 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 blah. Oh, you think Sicily was bad? Well, in Ireland, blah, 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 blah. And so it just, I don't know. It just felt like really, I don't know. It's like really hard to articulate, which I think, is what makes this movie so special.
I was mad during that song because all the stories were dudes telling stories.
Fair point. Yeah.
Which, like, this, I mean, that shows up in this movie as much as it does in anything else. that we've talked about, I think, because, like, so you have the mom and the sister, but they're very, very secondary to Feifel and the dad, even. Like, the like, father-son relationship in this is so, so, so strong, and they really spend time building it, and they don't do the same for the female characters.
Yeah.
And then, that's true. So there's two like, kind of prominent female mice characters in this movie whose names I don't remember. Do you remember their names, Kara? The activist mouse and the rich mouse?
No, let's see. Okay, so Tanya Moskovitz is his sister.
Is his sister, yeah. And they do let her have, like, half a song, which is cool.
Yeah. And actually, in Feifel Goes West, she gets to have her own storyline where she's chasing her own dream, which is cool. Yeah. Gussie Mausheimer. I think that's... Is that the...
I think that's the rich lady.
So that's Madeline Kahn does that voice. I don't know.
Hold on, I'll look too.
Wait. So, Bridget?
Sure.
I think I mostly thought that was his sister. Like, right? Because there's his friend.
Tony.
Is that what his name is?
Yeah, his name's Tony.
Tony Taponi. Oh, that's his name. Okay, so Tony, that's, he, like, falls in love with
that mouse. The
mouse that
he's in love with, yeah.
Right, okay, yeah. So
Bridget? Her name's Bridget?
Apparently. Maybe we never even learned her name. Like, that's a very... Yeah. That's a very reasonable possibility that they just, she doesn't even have a name.
But she's super cool.
I don't know, I think, yeah, she is cool.
But I mean, yeah, that's, those are the only female characters.
Yeah.
And even Bridget is used as, like, a stand-in mother for Feifel.
Right. Just mother and object of infatuation. By Tony.
Mostly. I mean, she has her own thing, too, but...
Yeah. But the mice are kind of duped by a man who is ostensibly a rat, Warren T. Rat, who turns out to be a cat who's tricking them. I don't remember what he's tricking them into in this movie.
I did kind of a bad job of paying attention to the middle of this movie. But
yeah, the middle's not great.
And, like, that's where that part happens. So, like, yeah. I don't know. I couldn't tell you either.
Why? Well, in Feifel Goes West, it's a pretty similar storyline. And in that one, the cats are like, we're totally cool with you guys. Like, it's fine. We're all living together. And then he, like, tricks the mice into building their own giant mousetrap. So it's some sort of situation like that in this movie. But Warren T. Rat is the worst. Also, anyone named Warren, big red flag.
Oh, yeah? I only know one Warren.
I dated one, and he is definitely a very bad person.
Oh, okay.
So, just next time you meet somebody named Warren who's masquerading as a rat, he might actually be a cat. Just keep that in mind.
Can I go back to the beginning for just a second?
Sure.
You know how there's like that, like the YouTube video that went around for a little while, and it was just like all the Disney princesses dancing the exact same way. Have you ever seen that? Where basically they just like steal from one movie to another.
Yeah. Well, I have not seen that, but I know exactly what you mean.
To me, and I don't think they actually did this because this wasn't a Disney movie. But the beginning part where Feifel is. So he tries to do a brave thing when they're attacked in the beginning, too. He's like, I'll save us! And he runs out, like, into the snow and the fire, and he's, like, being all brave.
Right, and that's the first time that we see him... We see his parents see him, like, possibly go, like, die or go away forever.
So the cats are chasing him, and it looks exactly like when Ariel is getting chased by the shark in The Little Mermaid.
Oh, really?
Exactly like it. Like,
interesting.
Like when, because there's that part in The Little Mermaid where she swims through the tiny thing and then the shark follows her and he gets stuck. That's exactly how Feifel gets away in this.
Interesting.
He goes through a tiny thing and the cat gets stuck.
Yeah. Well, so this came out in 86 and The Little Mermaid was 89, so I wonder if the
The Little Mermaid stole from this.
Or not stole from, but was influenced by.
No, I mean, also it's like a pretty, you got a big thing chasing a small thing. I think it's pretty
right.
easy to put that together.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of easy to draw from that. In Fievel Goes West, actually, the action sequences in that movie are spectacular. Like, it's everything that's like great about this movie, but like with I didn't look at the budgets or anything, but probably like twice the budget, and you know, obviously it was made later, so the technology was better and stuff. So I think technically Fievel Goes West, especially in the action sequences, is better, but they're both really wonderful. So you mentioned this is not a Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of Don Bluth's movies, who was, I don't know if he's still alive or not, an animator, director, producer, writer, production designer, etc. And
he's still alive.
Cool. Good for him.
He's 80.
You said that one of the reviews of this movie when it came out was that it was too sad, but Don Bluth is responsible for The Secret of Nim, An American Tale, The Land Before Time, and All Dogs Go to Heaven. So
every single sad movie?
Yeah, so all of the movies that like were, actually all of these were really important to me as a child.
Well, we've talked, like, okay, this is just making me think about like kids' movies, and like we've talked about this before, obviously, on this podcast, but it's like, mm-hmm. in movies that are centered around kids, you have to find a way to get rid of the adults.
Right.
And like, usually it seems to be by killing
them. Killing their parents. Yeah.
Which inherently is very sad.
Yeah. Also, and we've definitely also talked about this, the death of mothers in particular, mm-hmm. Is really common. And there's been some like really great writing about that, and that kind of the cultural significance and historical reasons for that. I can't remember by whom, but there's a lot of it out there. So if you start Googling, you'll probably find it.
You all know how the internet works, right?
You know how the internet works, yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting to think about how... And this, like I was saying before, about maybe reimagining the scope of the podcast, that, you know, what we see and are exposed to as kids or adolescents is, like, goes into shaping our worldview and how we conceive of how the world works. And so I think maybe approaching things like through that lens instead of just like, oh, let's just like go back and see if something's still good,
mm-hmm.
might be a way to,
I mean, we definitely usually end up doing that anyway,
right?
Like, how fucked do you think it made us that everything we watched basically had the same storyline, which is like, bad thing happens, person works hard, person succeeds. Like, essentially, that's the plot of everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how fucked do you think that made us?
I don't know. Probably, to some extent. Yeah, because then you're left with the you think that as long as you try hard,
mm-hmm.
and like we were explicitly told this as children, or at least our generation was, that like you can do anything you put your mind to,
right?
And like, that's not true.
Right, it's very not true.
You cannot do anything. There are some,
and I mean, the economy was also really good when we were growing up, so like, well,
I mean,
it was
kind of
better than it is now
at times. At times.
A lot
yeah.
better than it is now. Like, I remember when I graduated college in 2008.
Oh, well, yeah, like, the financial crisis happened.
Literally just watching jobs disappear. So that's
yeah.
part of what I mean, is like, the stories we were being told were based on the assumption that the economy would remain good.
or not just good, but the same.
Yeah.
And I think that might be a more accurate way to frame it, because it's, I mean, it depends on, I guess, who you ask. It's not that the economy is bad now, per se. It's just radically different. And don't worry, it will get very bad very soon.
Great news.
Good news. But, like, I always had a really hard time imagining a future for myself, mm-hmm. like, especially in high school and stuff. I just was like, I don't know what I would want to be when I grow up. Like, you know, and it's because the things that I was going to be when I grew up, like, didn't exist at that time, you know? So...
Wait, what about them didn't exist?
I mean, I work in marketing mm-hmm. and do a lot of, like, social media stuff.
Oh, so yeah, that literally didn't exist.
It literally did not exist. You know, at a certain point in our childhood, the internet did not exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
You know, I also work for a subscription-based cut flower service. That did not exist. Mm-hmm. You know, so, like, all of these things, podcasts did not exist.
For all the money we make from our podcast.
Yeah. Rolling in it. Very lucrative business. So the economy just is completely different. And not just the economy, but just how we exist in the world is different because of the internet and because of the digital tools at our disposal. So the assumptions that things will always be the same.
Yeah, just... but, you know, we were raised by people who were kind of thinking that way. Like,
right.
Like, my mom owned a house by herself by the time she was my age. Just, like, had her own house, like, had a
That's
job.
Hilarious.
You know, had a regular job. Like,
yeah.
Which seems very easy compared to how it is now.
Yeah.
You know, and those are the people who raised us.
Right. And the assumption that, like...
And who were making our media at the time-ish.
Yes.
I mean...
Yeah. No, that's true. And, that, like, before them, it was... Because your mom's a baby boomer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So before them, it was the so-called greatest generation. And so there was just this assumption that, like, every generation would do better than the one that came before them. And, like, we're just on an upward trajectory forever.
Forever.
Which, if you pay any attention to history, you know that that is not true. And not going to happen. So, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's all, you know, and then add to that the gender dynamics mm-hmm. in the economy mm-hmm. and that at that time, you know, women were breaking into the workplace and whatever. And they imagined that by the time we were adults, like, sexism would be over and dead. And I was kind of raised to believe that that was the case. So it was very surprising to find myself.
That's, like, the message that we received as girls,
yeah.
for sure. But if you look, like, we see it over and over again with, like, the stuff that we were watching back then. Like, mm-hmm. that message doesn't really exist in... media, unless it's like
no.
you know, a very special episode. You know, like, unless somebody's like taking the time to on purpose like shine a light on it, it feels like very much like it didn't actually exist. It was just like
yeah.
people saying it to us, I guess, but then it's not like we got to live that,
right?
Or it's not like we get to live it now.
I mean,
we're doing better.
Yeah,
we're doing
yeah.
better.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
kind of, sometimes, maybe.
I don't know.
What?
I just started thinking about 9 to 5. We should do that.
I've never seen
it. Of the podcast. Oh my god,
I know.
It's so good. It's so special and wonderful. It is a true treasure. I mean, all-star cast.
I know.
You know, just so good.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We do want to watch it.
Great.
But it's like, you know, you had to make 9 to 5 to highlight mm-hmm. the working woman. You know, you don't just
right.
like watch a regular movie
and
there
girl.
Are working women
yeah.
in it, like along with the men and along with the everyone else, like.
Right. But we were I briefly mentioned before, like, American myths and American myth-making. And I think that, you know, we grew up with the myth that, like, sisters are doing it for themselves and, you know, they're entering the workplace and breaking the glass ceiling and, you know, all of these things that were not necessarily, the reality did not necessarily match the messaging. And we see that in this movie when they're in Russia and they hear that there are no cats in America and the streets are paved with cheese and all of these different mice from different places have heard some version of that, like, everything's great in America and you don't have any problems. And it made me, like, really angry that, like, for generations we pump out this propaganda that, like, America's the greatest and we have no problems and if you come here you can make it and lift yourself up by your bootstraps. And then people try and come here and we're like, fuck you, get out of here, or fuck you, we're putting you in a cage. Like, that just made me really mad.
Yeah, that's not cool.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it made watching this, like, extra upsetting right now. But also, like, so there is one line in this. I don't remember who said it. I should have written it down. I think maybe it was the bird. Like, when Feifel first arrives. Because he's all sad, and he's like, you know, I'm not gonna find my family, like, whatever. And the bird says, this is America, the place to find hope. And...
wait, what does he say?
This is America, the place to find hope. And, like, no matter how, like, inaccurate that is in practice, I don't think that that's untrue. Like, I think we all... all the good people still believe that, and still, like, that's still what we want our America to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, Barack Obama got elected on that premise, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, like, his whole campaign was hope. But also, I think that there's a long tradition in the United States, and even, like, pre-America, like, during colonial times, that this... the entire American mission and founding principle kind of is hope. Is this hope that, like, all right, so, like, we've definitely fucked this up, like, a bunch of times, but we're gonna get it right this time, you guys. You know what I mean? And, and again, that doesn't necessarily fold in the realities of, like, oh, I don't know, genocide of American Indians or slavery or, you know, all of the other, like, really horrendous things that the United States has done, mm-hmm. kind of, like, on the path to hope. I mean, that's what, aside from natural resources and stuff, that's kind of what fueled the westward expansion, mm-hmm. and, like, you know, coming here to start over and all of these things that are so deeply ingrained in the so-called American dream that no matter how many times the universe kind of, like, shoves our face in shit, like, there's still hope that, like, we can do it better next time, you know.
Yeah, and then we kind of fuck it up again, and then we try again.
Yeah.
Which part are we in now?
Definitely the fucking up part. I don't know. I mean, yes, definitely the fucking up part, but I think also there's this... because this is, like, the flip side of it is the constant looking back and saying, like, oh, but things were better when... you know what I mean? Like, there's this, like, weird kind of two-sided, like, oh, we'll do it better next time, but also things were better back then, which is obviously a fallacy for everyone but white men.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's a dark time. But also, you know, as a student of history, it's like, it's always been a dark time.
Yeah.
And this country has, like, a really... because we're, like, so unwilling to confront the darkness of our past and present, we're like doomed to repeat it over and over again, which is deeply upsetting for anyone interested in actual progress.
Yes. And too, like, I actually find this like too upsetting to think about most of the time.
Yeah.
Cause like, what am I supposed to do? You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really overwhelming, especially because there's just so much. Like, it's, oh God, if it wasn't so terrifying and so horrendous, like, right now, for so many people, it would be kind of, like, comically, like, it's, we have literal evil billionaires running the country.
Literal, yes.
You know, and it's just, it's absurd how much is so bad, and like, this is just the stuff that we're hearing about, you know what I mean? Like,
that's what I keep thinking about. Like, I keep thinking about, like, in 50 years, what does this look like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are...
Well, it's not going to look good.
It's going to look that much. Real bad, even if we come out of it on the plus side, which, like, who knows? We might not.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like we will at this point.
But yeah, like, what are we going to find out?
Right.
And how much worse is it going to seem?
Yeah. And what won't we find out because they're not keeping records, and because local journalism, like the people who would be investigating this kind of stuff, like those systems have collapsed, and you know, it's just it's really upsetting and awful, and it really bums me out. But like, you know, as someone who's deeply engaged in issues of healthcare and disability rights, bodily autonomy, like everything in that and related to that with regard to this administration is bad fucking news bears. Like, it's not okay. Like, by any stretch of the imagination, every day it gets worse, And that's just, like, one tiny sliver of what's going on. You know, like, if you, like, zoom out a little bit, it's like, oh, my God, immigration issues. Oh, my God, domestic policy and, like, trade policy and, like, all of these things that are just not great. not good at all.
I also just keep hoping, though, that, like, maybe this just wakes the rest of us up, you know?
Honestly, if people aren't awake yet, it's not going to happen. Like, it's not, I like can't do anything but make noises and like not words.
Well, but like, here's what I mean. Like part of the reason I feel like, what am I supposed to do, is because like, one of the things you can do is vote for different people to represent you in our government. I'm from a blue-ass state. Like, you know, yeah. Like, I'll vote, but, like, I'm from a very liberal state that has, like, almost no government representation because nobody lives in my state. You know, very few, whatever. So,
yeah.
Like...
Well, so, there are things that you can do. First of all, of course, you can always throw money, if you have it, at organizations who are working to support people in this time. Obviously, the ACLU needs their help. The Southern Poverty Law Center needs our help. National Abortion Funds needs our help. But there's the Sister District Project, which harnesses the energy of volunteers in deeply blue places to channel it to where it can make a real impact. So I don't know how it works exactly, but like, here we go, how it works. We connect you with your home team led by volunteer district captains. So they handpick a number of sister races in other states that are winnable, strategic, and have a great candidate, and assign your team to two of those races. And so then you work with your local team to fundraise, phone bank, postcard, text bank, and if you can, travel to the sister race community to knock on doors and get out the vote. So there are things that we can do, and it's important that we do those things. Also, contacting your elected representatives, like, yes, even if they are already on your side or whatever, you can still contact them, reiterate your support or not support, whatever the opposite of support is that I can't think of a word for right now. And also, like, to thank them for continuing to oppose fascism and, like, all of this horrendous shit that's going on. You know, because it's important that we don't stay silent, because, you know, your silence is complicity. So, I don't know. It is really overwhelming, though, and I find myself at least once a day wanting to dig a hole, climb inside of it, and then cover myself with dirt again, because I just, like, find it all so overwhelming and terrible.
I honestly
this
can't.
This is a fun episode.
I don't
huh?
even think about it anymore. Can we leave the political part of the podcast? I don't even have anything else to add.
Yeah, that's okay. We can do that.
Like, I'm just not, like, I've become so disconnected from it because it's so upsetting that, like, I'm not even well enough informed anymore to, like, talk smart about it, and we're recording this, so.
Yeah, no, that is fair, but at the same time, I would encourage you not to disconnect entirely, because that's how these motherfuckers win, so I'll leave you with that, I guess. The animation in this movie is gorgeous.
Do you know what I like that they did, like, a few times in this? The way they show, like, sunshine sparkle? That's the best way I know how to describe it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I love sunshine sparkle. Yes, it's my favorite thing in the world.
It's so pretty in this.
Yeah. I was floating on a lake the other day, and we had a similar moment where we were talking about what was going on in the world, and we were like, wait a minute. This is neither the time nor place. Look how beautiful this is. You know, so. I mean, that's how I've been coping kind of with this time, is to go out into the world and reacquaint myself with beauty and wonder and feeling a sense of awe, I think, is regenerative.
I agree with that. And that is also what I try to do. Like, I just try to wake up and, like, look around me and feel really lucky and feel really grateful and, like, not take that for granted and, you know. Mm-hmm. And Sunshine Sparkle does make me happy. Mm. Both in this movie and in real life.
Yeah.
Wait, I have a question about Fievel Goes West.
Yes.
Is it better than this movie?
I think they're both really wonderful.
Because, like, everybody who I said, like, you know, I have friends now, and they'll be like, oh, what are you doing on the podcast this week? And I said An American Tale, and at least three people were like, Fievel Goes West. And I was like, no, not that one.
Yeah. Joey said the same exact thing. I was recording with them for Watch the Throne. Hear me on an all-new episode tomorrow. I forget if he said he never saw them or not, so find out on that all-new episode of Watch the Throne. But yeah, I think... But part of that also, I think, is just when they came out and, like, how old people are, you know, and, like, whether or not... you know, whether... Like, because it's probably, for people our age, far more likely that people saw Fievel Goes West than... An American Tale, necessarily.
What year was Fievel Goes West?
I'm waiting for the page to load, and I will let you know when my internet gets there.
There were also, like, a bunch of other Fievel movies, right?
Yeah, but, like, not... Okay, so Fievel Goes West was 91, and this was 86, so... Yeah, there was, The Treasure of Manhattan Island in 1998, The Mystery of the Night Monster in 1999... Fievel's American Tales, 1992. I don't know what that is. Maybe a TV show? Who knows? But I think, you know, an American Tale and Fievel Goes West are, like, the canon.
Yeah.
Like, officially. I was... Have you seen that Spielberg documentary on HBO?
No.
Okay. It's excellent. I just watched it the other night. Interesting.
What part of him? Oh, you know what? I heard somebody talking about it, and they were like, yeah, it was great, and it included a lot of things, and they really glazed over Hook.
Oh my god, they didn't mention it once. They literally didn't mention Hook once. At the very end, like, during, like, the ending narration, they showed, like, a 5-second clip and just said, some, you know, like, in the course of saying, like, some things worked out and some things didn't, and, like, some things didn't. A 5-second clip of Hook, and that was it. Didn't mention it once. I found that hilarious.
Was it just, like, a documentary about his work, or what?
His work and his life, okay. Yeah. Which is really, I, like, didn't know a lot of this stuff. Like, I didn't know he grew up Orthodox. And then his second wife, I guess, converted to Judaism when they got married, and that, like, reacquainted him with his relationship to Judaism, and that was when he made Schindler's List and stuff, mm-hmm. and that was when he started wearing baseball hats all the time. Because that was my that was the question okay. I went into the documentary with. Because, like, at the very beginning, you're seeing all these pictures of him, like, as, like, a young filmmaker. And I'm like, I wonder when he started wearing baseball hats. Because my image of Steven Spielberg is, like, goatee, baseball hat, glasses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and he looked, like, totally different when he was younger. So I was curious about that. But his grandfather's name was Feivel.
Oh.
And he executive produced the second one, at least. I don't know about the first one.
No, I think he was involved in the first one, too. And then, like, after the success of them, like, he had something to do with starting some kind of animation company. Right?
Yeah, he started DreamWorks.
But that's not what it was called then.
Okay. I don't know.
So I, like, really, really just quickly scanned the Wikipedia article.
Yeah.
I'm filled with facts about this.
Okay, yeah, so it was, An American Tale was produced by Amblin.
Oh, right, okay, so yeah, that kind of became DreamWorks in the, like, mid-90s.
Maybe.
That's what Wikipedia says. I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, okay.
Amblimation so obviously was the animation production arm of Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment. The studio was shut down in 1997, and some of the Amblimation staff, that's a hard word, went on to join DreamWorks Animation.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I guess he was a lot more involved in the second Feivel movie. Okay, so originally the concept consisted of an all-animal world like Disney's Robin Hood, but Bluth suggested featuring an animal world existing as a hidden society from the human world like Disney's The Rescuers. After viewing The Rescuers, Spielberg agreed. Emmy Award-winning writers Judy Freudberg and Tony Geiss were brought in to expand the script. When the initial script was complete, it was extremely long and heavily edited before its final release. Bluth felt uncomfortable with the main character's name, thinking Feivel was too foreign sounding, and he felt audiences wouldn't remember it. Spielberg disagreed. The character was named after his maternal grandfather, Philip Posner, whose Yiddish name was Feivel. The scene in which he presses up against the window to look into a classroom filled with American school mice is based on a story Spielberg remembered about his grandfather, who told him that Jews were only able to listen to lessons through open windows while sitting outside in the snow. Spielberg eventually won out, though something of a compromise was reached by having Tony refer to Feivel as Philly. Spielberg also had some material cut that he felt was too intense for children, including a scene Bluth was developing revolving around wave monsters while the family was at sea.
There is a wave monster in this, though, isn't there? Because I remember thinking that that also was like The Little Mermaid. Because it looks like
Ursula. There were definitely some like intense waves.
No, one of them's a monster.
Oh, okay.
It has, like, a monster. It's not, it's very brief, but it does have, like, a face, because I remember thinking, like, I always wonder when I watch a kid's movie, like, some of the things that happen, like, is that I'm supposed to be looking at it through the eyes of this child, and so that's what it looks like to this child, which explains away a lot of weird things. And that's how I thought about the wave monster in this. I was like, oh, like, yes, that's what that looks like to a 6-year-old.
Interesting.
But maybe the wave monsters had a longer scene that got cut.
Right. This was Universal Pictures' first animated feature film since Pinocchio in Outer Space in 1965.
Pinocchio in Outer Space? They made more than one Pinocchio?
Apparently.
All right.
Maybe that one didn't make it into the canon. But, okay, yeah, so production began in 84 as a collaboration between Spielberg, Bluth, and Universal, based on a concept by David Kirschner. And Spielberg had asked Bluth to, quote, make something pretty like you did in Nim,
it beautiful. What is Nim? I've never seen that one.
Oh, The Secret of Nim. Apparently it's based on a children's novel.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I can't remember.
Oh, it looks scary.
It is scary. Ooh. Yeah, it's scary and sad. But it's really sweet. And they make like a cute little airplane out of some leaves. Maybe I'm thinking of a different movie. I don't know. I have to rewatch this one now. Let me look at some pictures. I think a lot of people confuse it with like Watership Down. Which is another fucking terrifying. Oh my god, don't see that one. It's really scary.
Is it a kids' movie?
Yeah. Yeah, it's horrifying. There's bunnies and rats, and it's just deeply disturbing.
Oh, okay. I'm looking at, I googled it, and one of the screen grab for the video is two bunnies covered in blood.
Yeah.
Hugging? Or fighting. They look like they're hugging, but they're covered in blood, so.
That was like a really traumatizing experience with seeing that movie as a kid. But The Secret of Nim is really sweet and wonderful, and I like it a lot. They're very, like, his stuff is a lot darker than Disney stuff. But that's why I like it, because it feels like there's more of a balance between the, like, saccharine.
Yeah. Well, like, because Disney stuff is really dark, too, if you think hard about it. But they don't, right. They kind of, like, glaze over that, like, how dark it actually is.
Uh-huh.
Whereas, like, these do that a little bit, but not as much, maybe.
Yeah, I think that the darkness is out in the open in these. Whereas with Disney, it's, like, more of a thinker. Oh, Tiger, his cat friend.
Mm-hmm.
I love him so much.
Super cool. What's the song that he sings?
I don't know.
What do they sing together? Oh, the song about them being a duo. We're a duo.
Oh, yeah.
A duo. And I know the rest of the words.
Yeah, no, that's really cute. Played by Dom DeLuise, which I was on the last episode of Monkey Club. A since defunct podcast here on the podcast network. I forget what the movie was. I think it was called Going Bananas, maybe? I don't know.
That sounds like a monkey movie.
It's not. Well, maybe. Is it? I don't remember. It wasn't very memorable, but Dom DeLuise is in it. And they asked me to rename the movie, and I called it An African Tale, Fievel Goes Bananas. Because it's like some weird, like, you know, journey through Africa. Very problematic, but it's good that that is lost in history. Dom DeLuise is so good in this, and he's also really wonderful in Fievel Goes West. He's a pretty main character in that.
Did we already say that this was the highest grossing non-Disney animated film when it came out?
No.
It was. I'm sure it's not anymore. Uh-huh. But at the time it was. So it was kind of a big deal, I guess.
Yeah. Oh. Bluth worked with Amblin Entertainment and the Sears marketing department to develop the look of the film and its characters. Apparently Sears had a major marketing push on the main character. So maybe that's why everyone remembers Fievel.
Okay, so I feel like the most memorable... Tell me if I'm wrong. The most memorable song from this is Somewhere Out There?
I guess so. I mean, I think No Cats in America is also...
Yeah, I think it's those two. But I felt really, like, upset watching it this time because the kids in Somewhere Out There, that song is too high for both of them to sing.
I know, but that's what I love
awful.
About it.
It's like, awful!
That's so funny. No, I loved that... Like, not only did they have a hard time reaching the notes, but I liked that they sounded like children when they were singing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
They didn't sound super polished and, you know, like, whatever. They sounded like little kids singing a song that, like, wasn't necessarily written for their range.
Okay, except this song was written for this movie for them to sing.
I know, but, like, in the world of the movie, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I love that song, though. It's really beautiful.
I cried the whole time.
Yeah. We had a somewhere out there moment recently when I had posted a picture of a sunset. You were like, I also watched the sunset that night. And I was like, we watched the same sunset.
Aw, yeah.
Which I just, I love, you know, the cosmos and celestial happenings for that reason. Because you can look at the sky and be like, somewhere out there is also looking at the sky right now.
Same
We're
sky.
Looking at the same thing.
Same sky, same cool. moon, same sun.
Yeah.
I have no more notes.
I don't either. I was just reading the Wikipedia article to see if there's anything else of that would be interesting.
It was Somewhere Out There was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Song. It won a Grammy. That song was nominated and won a lot more stuff than the movie actually did.
Interesting. So yeah, I guess that probably is the takeaway song. Although, for me, when I think of this movie, I think of No Cats in America.
But that could, I mean, I think they also, like, chose, well, it makes sense. They chose that as the song, though, and then, like, real artists recorded it. Like, it plays over the credits. I don't know who it is singing it.
Linda Ronstadt. That's who sang it.
I don't know who that is. Do I know who that is?
My parents had a lot of her records. I'm sure she had some hits, although I wouldn't be able to name them, but I remember coming across a lot of her records in their collection. So I'm sure she's very important.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Linda, if you're listening. We should know who you are.
I'm just young and dumb. My brain just doesn't have enough stuff in it yet.
Oh, okay. So during production, Amblin and Universal expected to view the dailies and approve all major work on the film, and various outside parties also requested changes here and there. This caused the production to buckle from excessive oversight and made Bluth feel like he was losing freedom of control over the production
process. They were micromanagers.
Micromanaging. As the release deadline approached, pressure grew throughout the crew and numerous problems arose, ranging from the slower than expected cell painting in Ireland, so they did most of the animation in Ireland, skipped over that part, to low footage output by some animators. Also, the songwriters had written the score much later than originally desired. Suddenly, scenes had to be dropped to save time and money, and new, shorter scenes had to be created to help pick up the story points lost in the process, sometimes making the storyline look jumbled. Notable cuts include the Maskevitz's journey across Europe. Oh, I would have liked to have seen that.
Well, that's very accurate for me, because they leave Russia on this boat, and then all of a sudden the boat's filled with people from all kinds of other places.
Yeah.
And I was like, how did they're just stopping everywhere and picking everyone up? Yeah, and then all of a sudden they're in America.
Yeah, that's exactly how
I did find that kind of annoying, that the people just appeared.
Which makes me think of Titanic, which also stopped in several ports before leaving Ireland for the United States. We didn't get to this when we did the Titanic episode, but bonus boat fact. That is also very much an immigrant story, even though, like, the main characters are both American, I guess. Yeah, Rose is from Philadelphia, and Jack is from, like, Wisconsin or something. In the background are hundreds of immigration stories, you know, whether it's Fabrizio and his Irish friend, or the mother reading or telling a story to her children, you know, as they are about to be drowned in a cabin. I think that gets really overlooked a lot of times in that movie and in that story in general, that, like, even some of the guys that were in the band were actually immigrating to the United States. They were using that passage as an opportunity to immigrate. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like so many of those stories, when they're told, really, like, skip over that, like, in between time, you know, whether it's in this movie or in other movies, or even, like, hearing it from your grandparents. Like,
well, because it's just that's like, just the nature.
Well,
of...
and then I bought a ticket, and then I got on a boat, and then the next thing you know,
it's like, that's just the nature of storytelling, though.
Right.
And like time constraints, you know, like,
yeah,
movies are 2 hours long, TV shows are 30 minutes or an hour long, even spread out over a whole season. Like, you just can't, you can't include everything.
Yeah. But I'm thinking more of, or just like in general, like, I don't know, I guess I would like to see that story of like, what, maybe it's just boring that like going from port to port and like getting delayed
well,
by
it, it's,
all sorts
it
of things.
It would derail the story in a way that doesn't serve FIFO anymore.
That's true. But I would like to see like something else maybe. Or I don't know, maybe that part of the story is like people skip over it because it's painful and boring, and I don't know. I just am very like fascinated by how people tell stories in general, but especially about immigration and migration, because you have to leave so much of it out.
Yeah.
And I'm always curious about like what gets left out.
Yeah.
Some other things that were cut out: a scene in which they first meet Tiger and he gets stuck up in a tree, an upbeat song that Fievel was planning to sing while imprisoned in the sweatshop, and a scene that gave greater explanation of the changing of names at Ellis Island. Cuts are also responsible for Baby Yasha's apparent appearance after the boat trip. Oh yeah, they had a baby.
They did have a baby, and then they kind of didn't anymore.
Yeah. Huh. Didn't notice that.
Like, they definitely had a baby in Russia, and then when do we see the baby again after that? On the boat?
Yeah, and never
That's
again.
That's kind of it, right?
Had to get it out of the movie. Yeah. Yikes. That's really funny.
Do they have a younger sibling in Fievel Goes West?
No, it was just him and his sister.
Oh, they, like, legit were just like, never mind.
I mean, it's entirely possible that that baby could have, like, picked up some illness in one of those port cities, and then the next thing you know, no baby anymore. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, that one of the things that could have happened, you know, in that time between when they get on the boat in Russia and when they land in America, you know, an entire lifetime of stories can play out.
Yeah, that's a different movie, though.
That is a different movie. I don't think Ellis Island was processing immigrants when this movie takes place, though.
You think the timeline is inaccurate?
I do believe the Cara deGrasse Tyson moment. Inaccurate. Ellis Island operated from 1892 until about 1954, although I think they stopped processing incoming immigrants, like, before... or maybe between World War One and World War Two. There was still like stuff happening there until the 50s, but it was mostly like a hospital or quarantine and a deportation site more than immigration. But this movie takes place
in 1885.
Yep. See? Inaccurate. But, I mean, it doesn't really matter whether it was, like, on Ellis Island or someplace else. The process was pretty similar, I think. Wow, this is a really long Wikipedia article.
It made me think of my Jewish relatives that came here.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I know, like, nothing about it. I don't even have anything else to say except that it made me think of them. And I know their names got changed when they came here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know that much about it. But they, you know, they came and they stayed in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They went to Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well, my grandparents came from Ireland. The reason I know this about Ellis Island is because they came after Ellis Island was being used for incoming immigrants. So I think they just went... Yeah, they just went, like, directly to Jersey City and they were like, this is fine! And they just stayed there forever. But I don't think there was no like changing of names that happened. and which is kind of unfortunate because having an apostrophe in your last name is like a really big pain in the ass. But that's okay. Oh, interesting. Art Spiegelman, who is a comic artist responsible for the book Mouse. Did you ever have to read that?
No.
Oh, it's intense, but it's really amazing. I actually had to wind up reading it twice in college. There are two graphic novels, Mouse 1 and Mouse 2, about, well, it's kind of a meta narrative. So, like, in the book, Art goes to talk to his father, who had survived concentration camps. I think he was in Auschwitz. And goes to talk to his father to, like, get this story from him because he never talked about it. And so he drew this into a graphic novel, these visits to his father and trying to get this information out of him, and then illustrates the stories within the novel. And it's really heavy. I had nightmares for weeks while I was reading them, but they're really, really good. But apparently Art Spiegelman, who wrote and drew them, accused Spielberg of plagiarism due to the fact that the Jews in An American Tale are depicted as mice in the film, just as... Oh, also, I forgot to mention this part. Spiegelman draws Jews as mice in the graphic novel, and I think the Nazis were drawn as cats, and Polish people were drawn as pigs. It's like this whole animal... you know, metaphor. Because apparently Jews as mice was a metaphor that he had adopted from Nazi propaganda. But instead of pursuing copyright litigation, he opted to beat its release date by convincing his publishers to... Oh, I didn't know this is why there's two volumes. Because he had them split Mouse into two volumes and published the first one before he even finished the second one, so he could get to market before An American Tale.
Good for him.
Yeah. Interesting. I did not know that.
Hey, Kara, I want to know what I've been doing since you started talking about Titanic.
Watching that GIF?
Uh-huh.
Nice. Nice.
Because when the world's shitty, there's still always Leo in that cigarette.
Yeah, that's very true. I have been listening to Paul Scheer's new podcast, Unspooled, where instead of watching bad movies, he watches good ones.
Yeah.
And they're like going through the AFI top 100 That's list or whatever cool, that is. That. Yeah, and they did a really great episode about Titanic, and they had boat facts that I did not come across in my own research.
More boat facts?
Up to and including that there were actually 5 Chinese people who survived the Titanic but were sent back immediately because of the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Can you imagine?
Isn't that fucked up?
Oh my God.
America.
Ugh.
This is America. Yeah. I guess we should maybe talk about the end of the movie.
What happens at the end? They find each other?
We used a secret weapon.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then they find each other.
The mice. Well, Feifel has the idea to build a giant... Is it a mouse or a cat? It's a mouse.
Yeah, I think so.
A giant mouse to fight the cats. So they do... And the giant...
They stack it with fireworks.
Yeah, and the giant mouse wins, and the cats go away.
Well, they're all chased onto a boat headed for Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah, and then what are they... They're saying... They said stuff that made me laugh on the boat.
It was kind of the opposite of the there's no cats in America. They were like, in Hong Kong, there's so many mice. Like, you're just going to be eaten.
That made me laugh.
All over the place. Yeah.
But also, that was not all of the cats in New York.
No.
five of them.
Yeah. Including Warren T. Rat, who is something of a caricature of like a Tammany Hall crime boss kind of guy.
Yeah.
Which was interesting because they really have that whole like Tammany Hall parallel system to the humans. That I found really interesting, but you wouldn't really pick up on if you're not familiar with, like, the history of late 19th century New York. But yeah, and then they get reunited, and they live happily ever after until they fall for it all again in An American Tale, Five Will Goes West.
How does he get lost in this Five Will Goes West?
So they all get on a train, and they're headed out west, and then something happens, and he falls off the train.
Oh my gosh.
I don't exactly
remember. Can't take this kid anywhere.
Yeah. You really can't. I honestly don't. It has something to do, because there's a warranty rat kind of figure in that movie who has this, like, enforcer who's this weird spider.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, they're like climbing underneath the train, and the spider like scares him and then he falls off. But Tiger was supposed to get on the train with them and he missed the train, so he's on his own parallel journey, and he and Fievel actually cross paths like multiple times on the journey, not even realizing how close they are to each other. At one point they're both wandering through the desert and they literally walk past each other and are like, "Hi, Mirage Tiger. Hi, Mirage."
Oh.
You know, and they're like, "Oh, I wish that was really you." And it really is them, but they don't realize it. There's some not great American Indian stuff in that movie. Because it's probably like the first Western that I ever saw and like really set me up for a lifetime of loving and then being deeply disappointed by Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
And so they use a lot of the tropes and even a lot of like shot for shot kind of, it's like a really kind of a masterpiece of a meta Western, but, Tiger gets like captured by the Indians and like, they think they're going to cook him and then they think he's a god and it's, you know, it's like that kind of weird stuff. But eventually they get reunited and then, because the reason that Fievel fell off the train was that he like overheard the cat plotting to build this giant mouse trap, capture all the mice and then eat them all. So he has this information and he's trying to get it to the other mice and he's looking for like a sheriff who he's heard all of these like, you know, wild stories about how cool and brave and tough that he is, but by the time he actually makes it out west, he learns that he's actually several decades late and that sheriff is like an old dog. And so he has to like convince him to like, you know, get ready to fight again. It's nice. I like it a lot. I don't know. Maybe I don't know if it's a better movie, but I think it like it's kind of the same movie but done better.
Well, and
if that makes sense.
It is more, it seems to be more memorable to people, or more people saw it.
Right. And like I said before, that like technically it's a better movie, just like as far as animation. Like some of the action sequences are kind of gimmicky, but like in a really fun way. And like it's like very easy to forgive the action for the sake of action because it's just really fun to watch. And then Fievel saves the day, and everyone's like, yay.
Of course.
And then they're reunited, and I guess this time, presumably, they live happily ever after. I don't know. I didn't see
it. No way.
There's
like three more movies.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Maybe the third one is a good suggestion for Mike's podcast, Third Time's a Charm.
Oh. It must be hard enough to watch the third in most of the series. I can't imagine also watching, like, a third children's animated film.
Yeah. The Treasure of Manhattan Island. So that's the name of the third one. I guess they make it back to New York?
They're all over the place.
Yeah. Or maybe in that movie the second one never happened. Says, in the historic melting pot of 19th century New York City, Fievel and the Mouskovitz family are struggling to make their American dream come true. But when a mysterious treasure map leads Fievel and his friends to a secret world of Native American mice living beneath the city, he finds something even more precarious than gold and jewels. Probably friendship. They don't say, but if I had to guess, it's that.
It does sound like maybe the second one never happened in that one.
Yeah. Don Bluth did not direct that one. But Dom DeLuise is in it still as Tiger. So who knows? So at the end of the movie, the big cat that they build is, they like stuff it full of fireworks, which really scares the cats. And on the 4th of July, I got to see Jaws in theaters, in a movie theater, which was super cool and wonderful because it's one of my favorite movies. And I had not seen it on a big screen before, and it was like seeing it for the first time, which was great. But after the movie was over, we went outside and were surrounded literally on all sides by fireworks shows, which sounds cool, but was actually really terrifying. And you could have chased me onto a boat to Hong Kong with that. It was really scary. It kind of felt like, oh, so this is what being surrounded by mortar fire is like. Ugh. And yeah, it was really upsetting. I almost had a panic attack.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. America.
I live in the middle.
How was your 4th of July?
I live in the middle of nowhere enough that we were like, let's not go to the fireworks. And so then we couldn't really hear them or see them at all. Instead, we went to the river and brought our own sparklers and looked at the stars.
Ooh, that sounds nice.
It was way better than fireworks.
I like fireworks as long as I can't see them, or what's even worse is that I can like feel the percussion inside my body.
Yeah.
And it makes my heart beat weird and makes me feel like physically ill. I don't know what that is, but it's something weird. So when we were crossing the Hudson River on our way home across the beautiful new Tappan Zee Bridge, they do a lot of fireworks shows like up and down the river. So it was really neat because we could see probably 6 different fireworks displays on either side of the bridge, and I couldn't hear them or feel them, which was wonderful.
Fireworks are just like one of those things that like people freak out about, and I'm just like, yeah, but why? Like, I don't really get it.
Yeah, I mean,
like, why? It's,
they're pretty look at. I think the why we light them on 4th of July is, I guess, in like remembrance of the Revolutionary War. You know, like, so the line from the national anthem, the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, it like came kind of into very sharp focus when I was standing in the middle of all of those fireworks displays on all sides. And it was like, oh, this is what war sounds like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But as to why we continue to do it now that it's been so divorced from that original meaning, I mean, people love blowing shit up. Especially Americans love blowing shit up. They're really pretty to look at, but at the same time, they terrify all of our pets.
I don't even, if you've seen fireworks once, you've seen fireworks. Like, I don't need to see them ever again.
Yeah. I don't know. I find them pretty, like, when I can't hear them, I find them very captivating. Like, they're really kind of amazing to look at. But also, like, the fact that like they have their origins in the American Revolutionary War, or at least like what they weren't invented by the Revolutionary War, obviously, but like that's why we do what we do with them, I guess.
Why do they light them off at baseball games, Kara?
Well, yeah, that's a fair point. But at the same time, what I was about to say is that they are nightmarish for people living with PTSD.
Can't even imagine. They must be terrible.
They are fucking awful. And, like, there's nothing like unexpected fireworks to remind you that PTSD is forever. And, it can come on and, like, you know, you might think that you're, like, doing good and then fireworks and then it's like, oh my God. You know, it's a nightmare. Don't worry, I'm gonna bring the podcast way back down again right for us to end it with. If we pay all this lip service to valuing our veterans, and then, you know, by while allegedly honoring their service and whatever, laid off tons of fireworks and really freak people out, I don't know, it just seems wrong. So I don't know why we're still doing fireworks. It seems just mean and terrible. So that's a good way to end the podcast, right?
Yeah, totally.
I did a really bad job of driving this boat, but
it's okay. The boat has landed.
Has it though?
Yeah. I feel safe and on shore.
Okay. Well,
safe's not the right word.
For all things wistful thinking, you can, and other Cage Club Podcast Network shows, you can find us at cageclub.me. Totally forgot what
if anybody
the URL
wants
was
to write my bio for cageclub.me, I'll pay you $5 to do it. It needs 3 more sentences that I apparently can't come up with myself.
Cool. Oh my god, we forgot to turn this into a circus show.
What?
This is a game. Remember how I said that a new game that we could play, since we talked about it with the Breakfast Club, is that you could turn things into a circus show. Do you have time for that?
Oh shit, I didn't prepare.
Okay, you know what?
This one's harder,
we'll start
too.
This
one's harder,
time.
Too, because it's really just Eiffel by himself for a lot of it.
Okay, so that's something to look forward to in future episodes of Wistful Thinking.
Yeah, I'll do better next
game
time.
Where we turn movies into circus shows. But if you want to see Jordan doing cool circus things on Instagram, you can follow her there.
At JordoPC.
And you can follow me on Instagram and all the other places at Bimps, BIMPSE. Follow Wistful Thinking at Wistful Pod. And we'll talk to you next time on the podcast. Bye.
Bye.